And before he starts, I'm going to start a random beep. And the rules of this thing is when it beeps, which is going to be sometime between now and an hour from now, it is going to, your work, Steve is going to break off. You're going to take down notes about what you're thinking about. And then at the end, we're going to talk about it. Fair enough?
Okay.
Yes.
Right. Well, and before I start, I just want to take the opportunity, as Wendell isn't here, and I'm the other of the three that started our discussion some years ago, just to say thanks on behalf of all of us for being back here again. It's great.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think we should clap as well. We haven't actually got into clapping yet, but I think it deserves a clap anyway. So the title of my talk, as it was written down on the program and as I gave it to Jack, was The Myth of the Inner, The Myth of the Given. I actually kind of was more tentative in my mind, so really it should have question marks at the end. actually I had another theme which is going to be interlocked, interleaved with the inner and the given, which is single. So it could have been called The Myth of the Inner, The Myth of the Given, The Myth of the Single. And I'm a little bit tentative about whether I really want to say, yes, these are myths. So really, perhaps it should just be called The Inner, The Given, The Single. So, the myth part is something I'll just say a little bit about. But basically, what I'm trying to demythologize, or at least question, invite you to explore with me and discuss and debate, is a certain picture of experiences in a exclusively or essentially, or you know, having a center of gravity, or at the very least that, you know, to invite you to focus your attention on other aspects to experience that may also be part of a broader picture and may possibly relate to things that Russ is saying and doing, saying about what he's doing and doing. In fact, I started with a little excerpt from Russ's book that he's written with Eric that's just come out. Eric, unfortunately, couldn't be here. Eric Schwitzgebel, who was at Oxford last summer. And it really was, it was very valuable, but in fact we discussed this very much this morning, so I don't have to go on about this too much. But just to point out that there was this, Eric did make a point about the word inner experience, because he, I think, was coming from, you know, similar kinds of philosophical places perhaps that I was. He's saying, I don't like the term because I think it favours experiences like thoughts and feelings, which are generally thought of as inner, over things like sensations, which are generally more outwardly directed. And you know, then he gives some of the reasons why he felt that wasn't the case, to do with sort of embodied or externalist or contextualist views of mind. And I'm sort of coming from a similar place. Russ had a response, going over many of the points which he made this morning, so I don't have to go through that. The myth, the idea of there being a myth, this phrase, for those who don't pick it up, perhaps because they haven't got the sort of philosophy, it comes from Wilfred Sellers, who wrote about what he called the myth of the given in the 50s. This is from his long essay, Empiricism and Philosophy of Mind. And just, this doesn't really matter, but just to show the kind of background, it's the myth of the given has got a certain currency in some philosophical circles at the moment, because some people were influenced quite a lot by Sellers. And the myth of the given in Sellers is, in one form at least, he wrote, is the idea that there must be a structure of particular matter of fact such that two things. Firstly, each fact can not only non-inferentially known to be the case, such that each fact can be non-inferentially known to be the case. It's a longer quote than not only refers to the bit that's in the dots. And secondly, such that the non-inferential knowledge of facts belonging to this structure constitutes the ultimate court of appeals for all factual claims about the world. And the idea is that, according to many philosophers, particularly ones who were dominant in the 50s, 30s, 40s, 50s, there were, you know, all our knowledge is founded upon direct deliverances of sense experience, which were called sense data, little bits of experience called sense data that were considered to be inner and indubitable, and the rock bottom of all our knowledge about the world. And the myth of the given in some way relates to some of these other myths that I'm, or possible myths that I'm going to be talking about, but I'm not going to do the kind of deconstruction job perhaps that Sellers was doing about his particular myth. So the idea, I'm now going to talk a little bit about what I'm, to build up the picture a little bit, just to, again, this will be slightly boring for the, you know, for the philosophers, but just to paint the picture, so it's, to establish, as it were, the context. So in describing people, we make an essential contrast between the inner and the outer events happening to a person. This is the sort of, you know, how it might be put. And conscious experiences, one might say, if one is part of this way of thinking, are internal events. They're available only to the person to whom they're internal. They contrast with such things as behaviour, which is external, with brain events, which are external, not obviously in the sense that they're located outside the body, but in the sense that they can be looked at by another person, their third person, as we say. It's become very popular to say, which are knowable by other observers under various selected conditions. And in finding out about our conscious experiences, perhaps we have in some way to introspect, to look inside ourselves, and possibly that's what the DES method is about. Maybe it's more than that, or maybe that's, Russ would not want to identify himself with that at all, with the idea of introspection. And obviously it raises questions like, well, inside where? Do we mean, is it inside the body, inside the brain? Is it inside some kind of mental space? Is it, are we talking in a literal sense of inside, or are we talking of a sort of metaphorical sense of inside? Does it matter where? Is it, does it have to be here or here? I'm sort of, you know, passing my, I'm mind, trying to remain mindful of the you know, the chest experiment as well. So where you know, location is, you know, that raises questions about location. Where exactly? What is it that we're talking about? What is the where question getting at? And it's linked, of course, with the problems of other minds. I say the problems because there are several. So here are at least three. I know when I experience pain or heat or visual brightness or whatever. But how do I know when you experience it, since I can only directly observe my own experience? What justifies my habitual inferences from your external behaviour to your inner states? So that's one, you know, that's a broad philosophical question of other minds. And then there's the question that, you know, the more specific question, how do people, two people know that their experiences of crimson or C sharp are identical? And then there's the more practical or psychological, perhaps, question, you know, leaving aside the philosophical worries, how do humans actually come to develop knowledge or understanding of the inner states of others? And that's been studied a lot by psychologists and others, as you know, over some time. And a sort of, you know, there are two dominant views, particularly within psychology, though it's spilled over into philosophical discussion. Philosophers have also been interested in the sort of third psychological question, and they've tried to philosophize about that as well, as they tend to. And there are two dominant views. First is that knowledge of our own. I'll say what those two views are in a minute. But basically, the idea behind both these views is that knowledge of our own inner conscious states is direct and non-inferential, whereas knowledge of the inner conscious states of others is indirect and inferential. So that's that contrast And that the knowledge that we get of others, of the states of others, the inner states of others, is gained by inference from, firstly, the perception of their behaviour, and secondly, one of two things. Either theory, some kind of theory, which is sometimes called folk psychology, and it's sometimes called theory of mind, and it's called other things as well, or by a process of simulation, where we see the behaviour, and then we do something like run a sort of movie script where we imagine ourselves going in the situation and doing that behaviour, and then try and see what we would be feeling, and then work out what the other person is feeling as a result of that simulation little exercise. Those are two sorts of views at the moment, and there's quite a war between those two, which is sometimes known as theory and simulation theory, TT or ST. And just, an illustration of the broad way of thinking. This is taken from a diagram, which I think was, I'm not sure if this was actually from Saussure, but I saw it in a book edited by Richard Stevens, which is actually an Open University textbook that was used by Max Velmans in a course for many years at Goldsmiths College, which I actually taught for 1 year and really enjoyed working on it because it's a wonderful book. I love this picture because it absolutely captures, one important aspect of the sort of inner experience view, which is a sort of model of communication where, person A is talking to person B, and person A has got a thought inside his head and communicates that through his lips. And if you see the dotted arrow from person A's lips go into person B's ear, which then goes to his brain, which then produces another thought, which isn't actually illustrated, which then produces speech, which then goes into person A's ear, and so on. So it's language is a kind of the communication of the thought inside the head of the communicator to the other person who's similarly communicating. So I think it's a lovely illustration of a stereotype, if you like, of the experience which underlies the inner experience view. And it may be right, or it may be largely right, or it may be typically right. But, I just want to suspend that for a minute and look at some of the other ideas which maybe suggest an alternative. The other mind's problem was critiqued many years ago by Max Scheler in a book called The Nature of Sympathy. And Daniel Zahavi wrote this wonderful paper called Beyond Empathy. I'm going to talk about lots of wonderful pieces of work actually here. Okay. Okay, now I believe what we're going to do is shift the actual discussion of the beat till after. Oh, yeah. Do you want to actually assign a person now, or do you want to do that later? Okay. All right. So Max Scheler, I think the book was called The Nature of Sympathy. I can't remember what it is in German. It was published originally in the 1920s, I think. And he said that he was talking about the other mind's problem, and saying that the problem is based upon false, at least two false presuppositions. One of which is that the point of departure is my own consciousness. In other words, my consciousness is original, and the other person's consciousness is kind of secondary. And the second presupposition, he said, was that our knowledge of the consciousness of others has this indirect inferential nature rather than direct. And Scheler maintained that in fact we can be directly aware. We are often, and maybe habitually, typically, directly aware of other people's consciousness, though not in the way that they are themselves. But we can be aware of another person's anger or worry or whatever, because we see it in them, just as you might see bread on the plate, but that's different from having the bread in the mouth, as it were. In fact, he thought that the other mind problem underestimates the difficulties in accessing self-experience. We could sometimes be rather opaque to ourselves, and overestimates the difficulties in accessing other experience. So this is a quote that's in various places. I've come across it several times. This is what Shaler has said. For we certainly believe ourselves to be directly acquainted with another person's joy in his laughter, with his sorrow and pain in his tears, with his shame in his blushing, with his entreaty in his outstretched hands, and with the tenor of his thoughts in the sound of his words. If anyone tells me that this is not perception, but cannot be so in view of the fact that a perception is simply a complex of physical sensations, I would beg him to turn aside from such questionable theories and address himself to the phenomenological facts. Well, that's, you know, something that Shaler thought, and you may agree or disagree, and we can maybe discuss that. Wittgenstein said similar things in various places in some of his writings. In Zettel, for example, he wrote, "Look into someone else's face and see the consciousness in it, and a particular shade of consciousness. You see on it, in it, joy, indifference, interest, excitement, torpor, and so on. Do you look into yourself in order to recognize the fury in his face?" Which is almost seems like a direct swipe at the simulation account. And he has various other things that also seem to be implicitly criticizing kind of cognitive theory-based account. And it's becoming popular to use these sorts of ideas from Shaler and Wittgenstein and elsewhere to produce a kind of inactive approach to the perception of the states of ourselves and others. Sean Gallagher, in a paper that's being published shortly in a journal called Consciousness and Cognition, is saying that we typically use neither theory nor simulation when we're sort of clocking the states of others, or grokking the states of others, if you like. We use direct perception, which is what his term, DP, if you like. And he calls direct perception inactive because he thinks it's smart, for various reasons. It's smart rather than dumb. We don't just kind of look at the bare facts, as it were, and then construct a theory or a story behind them. We see the anger. That's a fully kind of charged perception. It's a bit like looking at your car. This is an example he gives. You don't just see a red blob. You see the car sitting, on the sidewalk, on the road. It may be red, but you don't just see it as a red blob and then say and then work out that it's your car. It's based upon the smartness is based upon complex subpersonal processes, neural processes of various sort. These are tied to motor processes. He has got a particular way of explaining mirror neurons, and he dissociates himself from other explanations. And it's bound up with context, cultural norms, social interaction, and so on. But this direct perception is for Sean Gallagher. The centre, at least in this particular paper, is at the centre of what it is that we, as it were, enables us to know others, know the experience of others. We perceive in much in the way that Shaler and Wittgenstein seem to be saying in those quoted passages. So Sean writes, in our normal everyday encounters, we do not ordinarily need to go further than what is already the rich and complex comprehension that we gain through the perception of a situated agent. This perception is already informed by my own interaction with them and others, as well as by my previous situated experiences, my habitual ways of understanding, and by cultural norms and established practices and so forth. In cases which we encounter in our normal ordinary engagements, I do not have to start thinking about what might be going on in the other person's mind, since everything I need for understanding her is there in her action and in our shared world. And then there's more. I'll just let you read this rather than. I'm not off to the side, thinking or trying to figure out what a person's doing. I'm responding to them in an embodied way. Now, I've had some discussion about this particular paper with some colleagues. Well, with a colleague at Sussex, Ezekiel De Paolo, who actually was quite vitriolic about it. Tom was actually in on this email correspondence because he thought Gallagher was still, you know, had really sold the pass and hadn't properly taken account of the fact that we don't just observe. This is the essential point that Ezekiel put, and that which I think I agree with, and I'm going to talk a bit about this. We don't just observe, you know, our knowledge of others doesn't just come from observation, as it, but it comes from social interaction. Now, this is perhaps one little paragraph in a quite long paper where Sean talks about social interaction, and there isn't very much else in it, although I think that if pressed, maybe he would say, yes, it is really important too. But I think that what I want to say, and I want to use some of the work that Ezekiel has done with Hannah DeJager, is to show that, or to suggest that social interaction is actually really fundamental to the way we understand others and understand their inner states. And so the direct perception idea, which comes from Scheler and these passages in Wittgenstein and you know, Sean Gallagher's discussion here, is part of it, but only a part within this broader idea of social interaction. And much of what I'm going to talk about now is to do with this, the dynamic, if you like, of social interaction. Before I do that, I just want to raise a couple of questions with Sean's account. You can actually question it, of course, from two points of view, either from a conservative point of view or from a radical point of view. From a conservative point of view, you could say, well, you know, okay, we could directly perceive someone's anger, but we don't necessarily know what they're angry about. We can see they're lost in thought, but we don't know that, you know, that we might know the tenor of their thought, to use Wittgenstein's word, but we don't necessarily know the detailed content, which is a point that Ron made earlier, I think. And the second thing is that really the account, I wrote this rather hurriedly a couple of days ago. It should be, the account underemphasizes how opaque we are to others. We're constantly masking our states, and we might call these inner states. And this is something that I think Russ was getting at when he talked about the fact that often we might have things that are too personal for us to want to, you know, reveal if they come in the beep, you know. I think when, you know, if you're riding in the subway or in, you know, some place, or even now, you know, we might look around and say, well, I don't know what they're thinking. And we may actually set our face and our body language in a way to say, well, I don't really want people to know too much about what's going on because I want to remain private. And I think, so maybe there is a sort of, you know, overestimation anyway about. So I'm saying that, if you like, on behalf of the inner experience view.
We had examples of that in the beat. For example, I don't know that any of us thought, oh, Jack's angry at the 60s.
Mm-hmm. But I think you can also question Sean's account from a radical, more radical perspective, you know, side, if you like, by saying that it ignores this essential feature of, well, okay, here are two things, here are two thoughts. This is a new thought. It ignores the essential fact that the person whose states we're perceiving is also a perceiver of us or of others. And so when you perceive another, you are perceiving someone who's perceiving you, maybe perceiving you, perceiving them, and so on. And so there's a kind of hall of mirrors effect, you know, just like putting to, you know, going between two walls where there's a mirror on each wall and seeing this incredible, you know, disappearing corridor. And I think that seems to happen a lot in personal interaction, and actually takes gives it part of its the quality that it often has, which is sometimes very, very powerful, sometimes very disturbing, sometimes very pleasant, and, you know, has all sorts of other properties. But the other thing, I mean, the central thing is that by making direct perception central to the account of our knowledge of others in the way that Sean does in his paper, he's ignoring the dynamic social interactive dimensions, and that's something I want to say a little bit about. And one way of doing that is perhaps by saying, well, look, perhaps this isn't so much on the social interactive thing yet, but just another, maybe another sort of thing here, which goes back to a point that I raised in connection with Shayla. Sometimes we can be quite opaque to ourselves, and we could, I think there are some cases where you might know my conscious states or some aspects of my conscious states better than I do, which may sound really strange. And you may disagree, but I just want to put this to you. I want to run it past you to see how many of you might agree and how many might disagree. So here are a couple of examples, three examples. I could see he was still angry with me over the incident 10 years ago, even though he sincerely denied this when I asked him, and he clearly didn't perceive the anger in himself, you know. But I could see it was there, and it actually conditioned his consciousness of me and his interaction with me in some way. Okay, that's the first one. She looked tired, drained, but was blocking that awareness from herself because she had to carry on. I think that that happens a lot. No, I'm fine, and I really, you know, and someone may really, you know, believe they're fine and everything's fine, whereas there may be a deep problem, and that it actually conditions their consciousness in a way that they are alienated from or blocked from or whatever. The gentleness and compassion of his whole being and how he experienced life and other people was clear to anyone who spent time in his company, but one also knew that he would not dream of seeing himself in such a light. I think some people, you know, do have that sort of saintly characteristic, that they're unaware of this, compassion that deeply infuses everything they do and everything they feel, and it's a part of their consciousness. Maybe because it's so, you know, it's just not, they just don't see it in that way. But we can see it. So maybe, as it were, the outer, you know, consciousness has a kind of outer crust, I can put it that way, which, other observers can actually see. So this is a point about observation, although possibly not direct, I don't know. But now, going on to the social interactive idea, there are a number of phrases I just want to mention. Evan Thompson's phrase, self-other co-determination. Dan Zahavi's phrase, the bodily interlacement of selfhood and otherness. Sean Gallagher, in another paper, has used the phrase endogenous intersubjectivity, which is, you know, a nice phrase, it seems to be. And De Jager and Di Paolo, my two colleagues from Sussex, although Hannah is now somewhere else, talk about participatory sense-making. And so just to summarise where I'm going to go here, what I want to say is that the self-other relation is sometimes, often, typically, essentially, I don't know, and maybe none of these things, but, you know, is one where the mental product is a joint creation of the participants with his own autonomy rather than simply an aggregate of the individual participants' mental production. Sorry, it should be S apostrophe rather than apostrophe S. So that's the essential idea that I'm trying to
Steve, I need to clarify. You really are going further than that. I think you don't want it to just to be a joint. It's not just a joint causal outcome. You want it to actually somehow to be constituted by.
Yeah. Okay. So maybe it should be a joint. Well
creation. Yeah. It's ambiguous.
Yeah.
But I just wanted to be clear on that. You mean it to not just be.
Yeah.
Because my perceptions, for instance, are the joint causal outcome of the world and me. But it's not that sense. It's that you're after, right?
Yes. Yes. That's a good point, Ron. Yeah. Okay. Well, let me. So, I'm going to look at a couple of examples of this. From academic quarters, and then I'm going to show some examples that are more that are based on some musical cases. So I came across a reference to a paper, and I haven't actually seen this paper, but I like this idea so much I thought I'd put it in. The idea of coaction, which is described in this paper as one agent's action is influenced by or occurs in the context of another agent's, and together they do something that is not fully attributable to one alone. That's part of what I'm kind of getting at. But here, this is from the paper by Hannah and Ezekiel that I was referring to. Social interaction is a regulated coupling between at least two autonomous agents, where the regulation is aimed at aspects of the coupling itself, so that it constitutes an emergent autonomous organization in the domain of relational dynamics, without destroying in the process the autonomy of the agents involved, though the latter scope can be augmented or reduced. And I'll try and make sense of it. That's a bit of a mouthful. I'll try and make sense with an illustration. And this is what might be called the corridor dance, and this is a very familiar experience to us, which is where two people are, you know, walking down a long corridor towards each other, and they, you know, they're on the same side. They're both walking on the left, and obviously they can't pass. So they try to correct by moving to the other side, and they both move to the other side. So this is actually the quote from the paper as it's described. So the unintended coordinated change in individual position creates a symmetrical mirroring relation, so they both move to the other side. This symmetry, in combination with the spatial constraints of the corridor, increases the likelihood that the next move will also be a mirroring one, namely back to the first side again. The coordination maintains a property of the relational dynamics that forces the individuals to keep facing each other and consequently to remain in interaction, in spite of, or rather because of, their efforts to break from this situation. Coordinated sideways movements conserve symmetry, and symmetry promotes coordinated sideways movements. So what I think they're saying here is that despite the fact they both want to kind of get past each other, the actual aim to correct their position to enable that to happen sets up a dynamic of mirroring, which they have to break in some way before they can actually do the thing that they want to do. So the interaction has got a kind of autonomy which is beyond the, and in fact counter to the intentions of the individual agents. And so that's what I think they're trying to get at. They illustrate it by means of this. So the coordination is, if you like, the dynamic between their adjustment behavior. But the interaction is actually the entire episode, which has this autonomy because of the way that the coordination interacts with the interaction, if you see what I mean. It would be much better explained if they were here to explain it, but doing my best. So this implies a kind of methodological holism, which is that, is opposed to the sort of underlying individualism or atomism of traditional cognitive science in looking at social interaction. And just one last area where I want to look at this is the area of infant sociality. And I want to just discuss a paper by Colwyn Trevathan and Gussie Debbie Reddy, again, it comes from a book that Max put me onto. Well, in fact, he didn't put me onto it, he edited it. It's his monumental companion to consciousness that he edited with Susan Schneider, which I had to review. There's this wonderful paper, again, I have to say it's just wonderful, by these two people. And I just want to distribute two pages from it. If I can, if you could just pass those round. If you take one from the top and one from the bottom. Now, this is primarily a paper about consciousness, but it's really also about infant sociology, sociality. And I think that what they report a lot of research, and much of it will be familiar, things like the Mertzoff and Moore work on infants sticking their tongue out when they're newborn, and things like that. But I think it illustrates this endogenous sense of subjectivity of infant consciousness. And what I think it shows is that that even very small babies have got enormous sociality. In fact, sociality may well be prior to individuality, and I think a lot of people are saying this. Here's a sort of one of the diagrams from the paper. of the rhythm of behaviors in proto-conversation between a mother and a two-month-old child. And this is interesting alongside the Saussure diagram, which I showed earlier. It's in a way similar because it shows the ear and the perceptual side of things, but it also shows it's much more motoric and it's much more interactive, it's much more dynamic. This is actually one half of a diagram, the other half of which shows the development of some of the organs which assist that proto-sociality or proto-conversation in utero. So there is maybe even a kind of proto, and they actually argue that there's a kind of proto-intersubjectivity in uterine development. And here's a photo of a girl 30 minutes after birth, imitating her mother's or her carer's facial movements, which is, you know, sort of classic Meltzoff and Moore, work that highlighted this. Trivathan and Reddy say that there are sort of five stages of infant consciousness, many of which increasingly have a sort of social patterning to them. The formative stage in the embryo and early fetus, which is just, if you like, a preparation for consciousness and for sociality. The latent phase in the late fetus, where the fetus is beginning to act towards surroundings, sensitive to messages from the mother's body and voice, beginning of attachment relation, twins are relating to each other in the womb, and so on. The nascent phase at birth, where the infant is that the neonate is exploring things sensed outside the body, attending to attentions and emotions of other humans. The emergent phase of the infant after some months, where knowledge and skills build their scope and power within the making and breaking of collaborative relations. And then the sort of reflective transcendence stage of adulthood or growing up, which involves the internalizing language and culture. You can see that their view of how we are conscious is very much interlinked with their view of how we are social, and the child is seen as an essentially social creature. And if you think about it, a child has got very little to do but to look at its world, and its world, because of the mammalian nature, our world is going to consist of whoever is looking after us. Because of our altricial nature, it's going to look, we're going to be looking at whoever is looking after us. It's going to have to be almost always someone or some people. And there's going to be some source of nutrition, which hopefully will be the boob, but it might be a bottle, which is a kind of quasi-social interaction. The world of the infant actually is largely social anyway. We think of it as being, we think of ourselves as being born alone and dying alone, but we in fact, the opposite is the case. The diagrams on the sheets I've given out are pretty difficult to. It's just a kind of take home thing, just to show the complexity of what's going on and the richness of the research that is available and has been summarised in that paper. But I won't talk about it in any great detail because I want to move on. So. Just to sum up this, what I'm trying to present to you as for consideration, going beyond the idea of inner hidden single, what I want you to evaluate is the idea that talking of consciousness in this way, in these terms, radically distorts the ways in which consciousness enters into structures and is structured by the socio-dynamics of the shared intermanifest conscious world that unfolds between us in an ongoing medley of self-other interactions. Now, just to illustrate that, if I may, just a couple of things from the, my computer's going to allow me. It's not going back to the, okay, oh, that's because, anyway, yeah. Let me see if I can just, I forgot to load this, I should have had it already loaded for you. Some of you may have seen this, and I believe in the US this has become a sort of an advert, has been part of an advert. This is 9-month-old Ethan. Okay. Sorry, I'll get the full volume in a minute. Oh, maybe I switched it off. No, no, I got the wrong. Sorry, Ethan, I'm ruining your spot on my show. It's wonderful. Isn't it? Yeah, that's it. Yeah. Okay. So, right. Somehow I've got to get back into my piece. I just wanted to look at something from music. As you know, I'm quite interested in jazz. And
wait, can you explain what you showed us in that
one? Okay. All right. Well, it's really just data for discussion. But that was intended to illustrate the fact that babies are very highly social, and that there was, you know, well, okay, you might say it's just, you know, one individual was reacting to another individual, but there was a sort of sharedness to the situation, which I think had an autonomy within the, you know, over and above the two individuals that was, the child was participating in. But, you know, that's my way of describing it. And you may disagree, I don't know. Let me see where we're going now. I just want to, I won't put it back in full, but I want to just play a track from an album, which is by Bobby McFerrin and Chick Corea. I wanted to talk about improvisation, because it seems to me that that's a powerful way in which, in music, this phenomenon of social, if you like, the autonomy of shared interaction illustrates itself, and obviously it's particularly important in jazz. And this, you know, is just one of many I could have played, but I just thought it would be, you know, it's good as a kind of concrete illustration. So, see if I can find it. Okay, so this is called Blues Connotation, and it's a, you know, Ornette Coleman.
I'll just let it go on in the background. Okay. What I was trying to get at, and I'm not sure if this completely illustrates my point as fully as some of the more sort of free improvisation, is that the two players are, they're not, you know, they're not playing, they're not just as it were playing they're along separate tracks, but they're listening intensely to each other, and what they're doing is playing with the other. And this is an experience that, you know, if people who play improvisational music like blues, I was talking to Bob in the van yesterday, and we were, you know, discussing this a bit. You know, you can get it in relatively simple forms like blues, but also in more self-consciously group improvisatory forms like in free jazz, and I had other examples, but I've got time to go through them, where you're actually creating with the others, however many, one or more in the band, and you're deliberately throwing away as much as possible of the musical conventions in order to try to let what emerges really be what emerges from simply the logic of the interaction. Okay, so I see that as a kind of somehow symbolising this kind of interaction. And what I want to say is that in cases like this, there really is a kind of co-consciousness. And quite what I mean by that, maybe that's just a poetic way of saying something which, when unpacked, is going to be explicable in more traditional terms. I don't know, and that's what I'm interested to know what you think about. You know, it may be the right way to explain, or it may be an irrelevant way to explain something that isn't essentially right, or a wrong way to explain something that is essentially right but needs other ways of developing.
I think that's Ethan Rona. Yeah. Oh, can we?
That's it.
Oh.
Yeah, video as well. What was the other video you had?
Sorry?
Those two musicians.
Oh, okay. So if you insist. I think I've lost them.
I've seen that video with sound from the beginning as well.
Oh, you did see it more or less from the beginning. Wow. Mm-hmm. I'll show it again if you want, but oh, wait a minute, I've got to show.
We should have it running in the background for
the rest of the week.
The rest of the week.
Sorry, I need to show this through Explorer, which means I've got to open up a login session, which I then have to cancel.
I thought you had it open.
I did, but it's gone. I must have clicked the little X.
The demon.
So I'm going to have to find it again. So,
shall we talk amongst ourselves?
Talk to me.
But what if the structure chair began to ask you a question about?
Yes, please do.
I have, all the way through this, was thinking about Husserl's notion of a presentation and intentional transgression.
Right.
He seems to have.
Tell me more.
No, he has a, my thoughts of the other's thoughts, he says, about me, sorry, my thoughts of the other's thoughts about me shape my conscious conception of myself,
yeah.
And very possibly my unconscious conception of myself, and they shape my actions.
Mm. Yeah.
And that's this notion of a presentation in relation to human beings rather than in relation to other objects. Mm.
There's a lot there's a lot of phenomenological writing that's exactly about this, but there's enormous variation in what people say. So Husserl says one bunch of things, Heidegger says another, Sartre says another, Levinas says others, and some emphasize the kind of, you know, the intersubjectivity and the withness of being with others, and some emphasize the alterity, the otherness of others, and the transcendence of others. So that is found in both at the same time.
But in the notion of intentional transgression, I think it goes further than simply this notion of a presentation, because we are transgressing on the conscious intentionality of the other.
Mm.
We're understanding.
It does sound like a bit like a transgression against certain received ways of thinking. I mean, received non-continentally influenced ways of thinking.
In all this, there seems to be...
Sorry, I've got to take my wife first. Sorry about that.
I didn't go on.
There's
something
all
about
right.
projection and transference here. Classic sort of psychotherapy concept of projection and transference. When you're looking at, you said, I see the fury in the other person's face.
Yeah.
And I immediately think of those people who see somebody as angry when actually they're distressed.
Yes.
Because they're projecting their own
consciousness
onto the other person. And then transference is where, this comes back again.
Yes.
It becomes, it expands.
Yeah.
So I just think somewhere it would be useful. When we're looking at direct perception, it seems as though direct perception is... almost something that happens without anything behind it, the context, a whole system of values, experiences in the person who's doing the perception, which are then projected onto the person, or you might say, into the shared space between them.
Mm.
But I think I see them as being projected onto the person.
Yeah. Well, I think direct perception often it also involves direct misperception. And I think sometimes you're absolutely right. I mean, you don't just see the fury in the other, but you see what you think is the fury, but in fact is distress or something which you translate because you're projecting just the way that you say. There was a second point, but I've forgotten it. We'll come back to it. Maybe.
In a way, my comment fits on back neatly. My kind of first thing was that actually you are talking about something really important, this kind of co-creation of individuals and the kind of exploratory that the open-endedness of co-creation of new way of being, but as I was listening to the kind of there's a kind of dialectic always in these talks, you necessarily in a way have to kind of say, look, here's this position in contradistinction to this position, we need to correct this dominant ethic and things like maybe expanding to a kind of more social interactive way of
thinking.
But come back, aren't they? My own thinking was, but in a sense, these things, the two poles co-emerge.
Mm.
So you can't have a social interaction and without individuals in some way, and it's as much the individual shaping the interaction as the interaction is shaping the individual.
Yes.
And with the direct perception equally. That it's not in different situations, but any kind of perception. There is no such thing, really, as for us anyway. Unless you're maybe doing bleep experiments, but normal perception is always interpretative. Mm. And all the way from babyhood onwards, if we come back to babies, you know, we learn very early on to very usefully bring inferences to bear to kind of systematize the constant fluctuation around us. So all the way from object constancy, you know, the old business where you put an object in front of a baby, or maybe a toy, and they're really interested. And you put a blanket over the toy and they lose interest because they don't think the toy's there anymore. And there's a certain point, you know, very precise phase in infant development where they, the fact that they can't see the toy anymore doesn't make any difference. They know the toy's there and they're still interested in getting the toy.
Yeah.
So you know, we learn about the nature of it. And the same applies, I think, to the social situations. Mm. So I absolutely agree with you. It's not just projection, you know, and so on, but it's quite a skill. It's a little bit like there's that wonderful example of scientific perception, you know, and evidence in science. That I might look at an X-ray photo, for example.
Yeah,
doesn't mean much. Or I look down at my.
You need to be trained to see.
And you know, I can't quite make out which bits of the bits of the cell and you know, that other people see immediately. And I just think that social reading is like that too. That you know, to kind of sort of, for me, sort out my own projections, for example, or to use experience to try and make some sort of sense, which might be an accurate perception. It's kind of direct, but in a way it's not indirect at all, because perception is always tied up with cognition and interpretation. So it's again not an either or, but a kind of both and situation, I think.
Yes. I mean, you know, Trevathan, you know, you know, people like that, I think, are making the point that, you know, all the sort of the stuff about false belief tests, that, you know, being able to pass a false belief test, which has been logged at, you know, around 4 years old, and has been thought by some people to be the beginning of sociality, they're not denying that there are, you know, that is a stage, I think, a sort of maturational stage, but they're saying, look at all the enormous sociality stages that occur beforehand. So these skills are being, you know, developed, but I think that what's interesting is that they actually there are sort of elements of sociality, and possibly even you know, this is my point about, you know, when you're born, what you see is basically other people, because we're mammalian altricial species, you know. We have to be cared for by others, otherwise we won't get far, you know.
You're also sitting in a cot.
Well, yeah, fact, you know, yeah. Okay. Okay, but
I'm,
I think,
not denying.
Yeah. But so in fact, I think there's quite a lot of sociality from the beginning, and maybe more other directedness than inner directedness, because you, after all, again, we don't see our faces, and in a world without mirrors, in a society without mirrors, maybe they had very different views of themselves anyway. Because I think a lot of, this is a point I didn't make, but you know, maybe a lot of our sense of ourselves comes from the ubiquity of mirrors in our world, in our society, and now more and more seeing ourselves on TV Facebook. Cameras. Sorry?
Facebook.
Well, whatever, you know. I mean, that's, I'm afraid I'm not of that society, not of that generation. But yeah, maybe. So, you know, who knows what our kids are going to be? What sort of kind of self? Other relations our kids may have. Anyway, sorry.
I was interested in pre-nascent activity. Pre-nascent,
well, you can read it on these sheets. I mean, it's some.
Oh, yes. But it's also something I've talked about in
prenatal.
In relation to my. Some of my classes, I've talked to students about this notion. And it seems. Through looking at Trevathan's work and so on, it's occurred to me that the sense of ownership can of your body can develop, and the sense of mindness of my experience can develop in the womb, simply from the fact that in some ways, sometimes you move, and that you get some sensory feedback from that, but you have no idea of it being your sensory feedback, and mm-hmm. obviously that isn't possible at that stage. But then there's other times that the mother or somebody else will touch the belly and move mm-hmm. things, or move the when you see a little foot, move the feel a little movement inside and move mm-hmm. it. So at some point, there are actions that are not yours, that are not directed by you. Mm. And I imagine that there's a difference in the feeling that you would have. And I'm not quite sure how to take that. And I know somebody else has thought, well, I know that Gallagher and Bellsworth have talked a little bit about that.
Mm.
But it seems to me there that you could have some beginnings of a sense of self and other.
Yeah.
But I'm not
sure. Well, I mean, there's been some work at Sarvathan and Reddy talk about fMRI work on voice. Voice registration in the womb, which I can't remember exactly the details of it, but that, you know, it's more. I think the auditory stimulus is a very important. I think they're more easily experimentally, isolable.
But we know when we're moving of our own volition and when somebody else moves us. Yeah. And I just think that might start that early on.
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. I see what you mean. Well, they will, of course, be moving because the mother is moving, walking and sitting down. And
moving around in the womb and pressing, moving your hands out or stretching your hands, your feet, something like this. And you get the sense of being enclosed or in space. Mm-hmm. There is a restriction, a boundary to this movement. Mm-hmm. But then sometimes also, stomach will be massaged or whatever, and the child will be moved, the infant will be moved without it being those actions being directed by itself.
Maybe.
Okay. Well, yes, I mean, when your baby's uncomfortable, you will sometimes move it. when it's late pregnancy, sometimes you move it over.
Oh, but I just wondered how far back you could take that to the creation of self and other. Whatever the prenatal.
Fundamental tip, I think you're right.
Mm. I'm thinking all the way back to late adolescence.
You never know bounds, do you?
Yeah, I feel like I'm lost and left behind because I'm not quite sure what you were trying to advocate and how what you showed us supports it. So one thing I think I got from, I think you're saying is that the direct perception view, how we know what other people's mental states are, the direct perception view is a step in the right direction, but it's not enough.
Mm.
That seemed to be something you were saying.
Yeah.
And I didn't understand how you showed that. So one part where it looked like you were arguing against direct perception views, where you said that you gave the Hall of Mirrors example, and you talked about this interaction.
Mm.
But I don't see why. It's, I mean,
yeah, that's not I think I wasn't intending that to be directly an argument.
That was the radical. You
that
said
was just a kind of one. That was a one slide which I probably put in the wrong place. I was just making an observation that I wanted to get in somewhere. So it actually interrupted the flow of the argument.
So
the argument was more using
rejection of the direct perception view, which
is more
seemed right to me. And then there was a radical rejection of the direct perception view, which said it's not just that we hide are often hiding our internal states so you can't see, but actually my own conscious state is the result of what Susan was saying, Sorrel was saying. My understanding of how you're thinking of me, and so on and so forth. So you set this whole thing. But I don't see why that argues against direct perception view. So suppose there is that interaction. I don't see why you can't just. We can look at whole mirrors, right? We can perceive, whole mirrors, right? We can see that, and you can give it a person. So why can't you also give a perceptual account of the metaphorical whole mirrors? Why can't you say we just see this relationship between us? And we can see what the other's mental state is, even taking into account what they think of me and how I think of them.
Yes. Well, maybe what I was saying, maybe one of the things that underlay my Hall of Mirrors point was that This is it seems to me an important feature of direct face-to-face interaction that was entirely absent from that, you know, from Sean's paper, this particular paper, which I think would have enhanced his account. Okay. Now it doesn't actually argue against it, but at least it would have deepened, enriched, you know, his account of direct perception. But then a separate point that I was making is that, you know, he was putting too much emphasis on the perceptual aspects of the self-other relation rather than the interactional, you know, dynamic aspects. I mean,
okay.
The word dynamic is incredibly...
Say
you know,
something about that then. How
yeah,
is it
well,
that
was where I was trying to use...
Moving to the dynamics gives a different account of how we know the experiential states of others. So that's what I didn't see.
Because
okay,
what
so
I'm saying is that the knowing, and knowing itself is part of the problem is that the problem, you know, there's this problem, how do we know the states of others is kind of, you know, looming. It's so big that we can't actually see that there's this more, you know, it's part of a bigger question is what is it? What is the relation between the self and the other? You know, and it's partly a question of knowing, but it's actually, you know, a question of all the ways we relate to each other. We relate to, you know, a lot of the time we are saying, what the hell's going on? Why did that person say that? Or what's that look mean? And we are wondering, you know, an enormous amount of the time. And we're saying, oh, I must, you know, control my face and make sure that I don't, you know, betray, you know, this embarrassing or whatever feeling that I'm having. But, you know, a lot of the time we're doing lots of other things besides, you know, it's not an epistemic thing at all. It's a you know, an interactive or a co-creative thing, you know, like when we're playing music together. We're not saying, oh, I wonder what Ron's going to play next, or, you know, I wonder if Ron really is, you know, thinking. We're saying, oh, you know, we're sort of, oh, that's interesting, you know, that's interesting, I must match that, I must, flow with that, glide with that. You know,
so what you're saying is a lot of times you don't have to have knowledge of others' mental states, you just interact with them appropriately because of social skills, etc. That's fine, but what about the cases where we do actually know we have knowledge of other people's mental states? Then we can ask the question, how do we have that knowledge and how is it justified?
Well, and
I'm not sure
I would
how,
say that we,
how the social
part of
dynamics
the knowledge,
right
part
now
of
can contribute to that in any way, because it looks like you the traditional question gets restated, and everything you've said is just, oh yeah, there's lots of times where we don't have knowledge and we interact appropriately,
yeah,
and it's not on the basis
of
knowledge, but when we do have knowledge.
Okay, I see where you're getting, where you're coming from. Well, part of, I mean, one immediate answer, and this may not be the best response I can give, but one is part of the answer might be to think of, you know, what happens when we want to find out why has this, you know, I don't know, this computer or this radio or whatever, you know, why isn't it working properly? We don't just, well, we perceive it, but we also pick it up and, you know, turn it around and look at it and do things to it. So it's as much a motor, you know, interaction as a perceptual interaction. Okay, so that already shows that when we're finding out about things, we're not just using our perception, our sense modalities. There's a quite tight sort of sensory motor loop, and it seems to me the same is true of social interaction. When we're finding out about each other, when we're exploring each other, we're doing more than just perceiving. We're talking. Our talking is, you know, and our movements and our body language and our, you know, whatever else we're doing, is incredibly exploratory and
children above a certain age can answer the Sally Ann task correctly, and they don't need to go talk to Sally Ann and interact and probe Sally Ann and you know they can. It does seem like we do have capacities.
We do. I wouldn't deny that, and Sean wouldn't deny that as well. I mean, now you're on a the question is, you know, is the direct perception view, or do we have to go back to something like a theory view, which is the Sally Ann test shows that in its best light. But clearly there are many situations where we have a quite complex cognitive task to perform in trying to as it were, tell the precise story of what another person is thinking or feeling or about something, because there's some kind of confusion going on or some effect that's and in fact the Sally Ann situation is, I think, a kind of what might be called a Stroop situation, because there is, maybe you misusing the term, but where we've got a kind of for those who just remind people, the child is sitting down looking at a puppet show. This is one version of it. And Sally comes into the room and takes, with holding a bar of chocolates, and puts the chocolate in one in a blue cupboard, and then goes out of the room. And then Anne comes into the room and takes the chocolate out of the blue cupboard and puts it in the red cupboard, and then goes out of the room. And then Sally comes in the room again. And then the child is asked, where does Sally think the chocolate is? And it could be either theory of mind, they say, oh, it's in the first cupboard. But afterwards they manage to say it's in the second cupboard. But I think one of the things that makes that difficult is that there is a sort of overlay, an interference between, the thought about where you know the chocolate is, because you've seen it put in the second cupboard, and the thought about Sally, who hasn't seen it, and so there is a kind of cognitive difficulty, cognitive hurdle that has to be overcome, which is a bit like a Stroop effect, where I think is it you're shown the word yellow and it's written in red. It's not Stroop. Okay, well maybe.
Well, the Stroop color word test, that is.
Well, the thing about the Stroop thing is it's a conflict between conscious processing of a voluntary kind and unconscious processing of an involuntary kind. And you just can't stop processing in an involuntary way in order to make it easier to process in a voluntary way.
Okay.
I don't think that's the same.
No, it's not the same. Thank you for that. But it has just this one feature of there being a kind of overlay between two conflicting constructions, if you like. Which makes it more difficult than it might otherwise be, and which means that a child has to have got to a certain stage of cognitive development for them to handle that kind of cognitive complexity. So what I'm saying is that it's a rather special kind of case, okay?
But
and obviously, in that kind of case, we probably do need some
monkeys have to be able to do this, and they exploit this feature to behave one way. Behave around their superior as if they don't know where a piece of food is, so that their superior won't go for the food, and then only when he's away, then go for the food. So they have to,
I don't know, because now we're getting into the niceties of the research, and it may be that when the situation is practically informed by things that are personal to the subject, the subject of the test, they perform differently and better, perhaps, because a bit like Wason, the four. Card selection thing, which works better when you're, at the supermarket, as it were, and you're asked, well, what do I need to, to turn over in order to get the money or something.
I'm thinking we need to allow time for.
Yeah,
the
sorry, energy. I'm getting. Yeah, sorry. I'm really out of my depth here, also, because this is all. Sorry.
Well, one more comment, because you had your hand up a long time, but then after that.
When you spoke about Max Scheler, I was interested that you cut the description at the middle, because I think Max Scheler was even more radical than you explained.
Yes.
He might have agreed with you to a certain extent. Max Scheler went as far as saying that our primitive being was entirely interactive and social.
Mm.
There was no point asking whether there was an I or another and so on. Mm. And then the problem was to understand how two things crystallized. Think of, first of all, how the I crystallized out of this continuum of undifferentiated identity.
Mm.
And secondly, how we withdrew our investment in the world and in society, and in a wider society than we think now. Not only a society of human beings, but also a society of
animals, of rocks, and so on, which were all considered as having, well, personality.
Animism.
So, in that case, the problem was how everything crystallizes and the contracts, so to speak, in little units of isolated experience.
Of meanness.
So this is the other problem. I would say the reciprocal problem with respect to the so-called problem of other mind.
Yes, yes.
The problem of how I
how get to know about me.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Lovely. Yeah.
Okay, why don't we stop there then?
Thank you very much. Yeah. I just wanted to say that, what I really want to do, and I've invited Russ and Ron to join me in this, and or both, is to maybe do some kind of musical exploration. And so maybe we'll talk about that later and see if we can find a slot for it. Okay. Sorry, I wasn't trying to elicit the clap. I just...